This is Fresh Air. You know who's doing a cabaret act at Rainbow and Stars, one of New York's top rooms? Leslie Gore. Everyone who listened to Top 40 radio in the mid-60s knew her hits. It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me, That's the Way Boys Are, and Maybe I Know. You know who produced her? Quincy Jones. These were some of his big pop records long before the Michael Jackson days. In Gore's cabaret act, she sings Porter and Gershwin, as well as the songs that made her famous. She's still singing this one, my favorite. It's a song she chose herself.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys.
At the time, I know I chose it because I liked the strength in the lyric. But for me, it was not a song about being a woman. It was a song about being a person and what was involved with that. Of course, it got picked up as an anthem for women, which makes me very proud. And today when I sing that song, I don't know, maybe it's after the Anita Hill hearings and a number of other things that have seem to be happening in our world, You Don't Own Me takes on a whole other set of meanings for me now.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have come to see it as a proto-feminist anthem.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't think of it that way when you were recording it?
I didn't. What I was impressed with was the strength. I've always hated wimpy woman. I've never understood it. So when I first heard this piece of material, I knew it was one I wanted to do.
Now, how did you choose it? How was it offered to you?
This is a great story. I was actually practically kidnapped in a hotel up in the Catskills, Grossinger's, when it was still in existence. I had gone up there to do some promotion for WAEB, and Gene Kay, who was a major disc jockey in the Allentown area, and I was sitting at the pool, and two young men from Philadelphia, John Madera and Dave White, literally took me into one of the cabanas and played me You Don't Own Me on just a guitar and sang it for me. I fell in love with it immediately, and I made an appointment for them to come into New York on Monday and sing it for Quincy Jones, who also loved it.
So they let you choose your own songs. I mean, I don't know if everybody had that opportunity.
Well, with Quincy and I, as a matter of fact, Quincy was into the show at the Rainbow and Stars a couple of Friday evenings ago, and we had a wonderful reunion, and one of the things we talked about was a couple of the songs that he made me record that I never wanted to record. And what we would do at that time is he would find something or say he didn't want me to record something, and we would negotiate it out. I would do the song I didn't want to do for him, and he would do the song ostensibly he didn't want to do but for me.
So which songs did he make you do?
Oh, there was a song called Sometimes I Wish I Were a Boy. I really hated that one. And there was another one called I Struck a Match. Oh, it was hateful. And as a matter of fact, we had a terrific joke about it. He got this fantastic velvet box from Cartier and presented it with to me the day that the album was released with I Struck a Match on it. And I opened it up and it was a huge wooden match.
Need I point out, these songs were not hits.
Need you point out, indeed. Of course not. I knew my stuff.
Now, what's the story behind how you made your first record?
Well, it's an unusual story, but not in showbiz terms. I was studying with a vocal coach in the New York area, a man by the name of Myron Earnhardt, and one day I went in to do my lesson, and he said to me that he had booked a tiny recording studio just upstairs from him. We took the piano player and went upstairs and did, I think, four piano voice demos, pretty much one, two, three, four, right in a row. And when I left there that day, I literally had two what looked like 78-size records and two songs, one on each side. And we pressed up a couple of these. And as it happened, a man by the name of Joe Glazer, who was the president of ABC Booking, which was a booking agency, met Irving Green, who was president of Mercury Records, and played him my demos. Irving was impressed with the fact that I was 16 and had an interesting feel for music, and he needed a project for Quincy Jones, so he put us together.
Was this the Joe Glazer who was Armstrong's agent, too?
That's exactly the man, yes. He was quite an individual, quite a man.
So It's My Party was the very first side you recorded?
That's right. Quincy brought maybe 200 demo records to my house several Saturdays before we had gone into the studio. And because I had never sat and picked this kind of material before, the first record he put on for me was a song called It's My Party, and it was demoed by, I don't actually know who actually sang the song. And it was a very spirited little tune, and I liked it because there was something kind of rebellious in its attitude. And when it was over, Quincy said, "Well, what do you think of that little bit?" So I said, "Well, I like it, but I don't know if it's... Let's put it in the maybe pile." And after we went through 200 demos, we had one maybe, and it was It's My Party.
So what do you remember of that first recording session when you made It's My Party?
Well, the first thing I remember, which is so different from today, is we recorded four-track. And I think most people know today that, gosh, we use 24, 32. Some people actually marry two machines and have 64 tracks. So the state of the art has greatly improved. This meant that we had two microphones basically hanging in the studio, strategically placed over the band. We had a third microphone in the center of all of the background singers, and there were about eight of them, and then I was in a little booth, and that was the fourth mic. So that was pretty much the setup. When we counted off, you heard everything that was going to be there. Today we layer a lot and we track a lot. Then you just went in and did it. When you walked out of the studio, you were pretty well mixed and knew exactly what everything sounded like.
Ms. Magazine, there was recently a piece with you and K.D. Lang having a conversation with each other.
Yes.
And you said that when you were a kid, you'd sing in front of the mirror and you'd slick back your hair like Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
But when you finally walked out on stage in the spring of 1963, you went dressed like a nice little girl and performed as you were expected to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare what you wanted to look like when you started to performing with how you ended up looking?
Well, I still basically have a very, I'm very sound-oriented. Image, which has become a major part of our business, is not what I would call my primary interest. So what it was really was sort of this, and you can probably relate, let's say you had a party to go to, and I might compare it to having the Ed Sullivan show to do. I would say to my mother or my cousin, "What do you think I should wear?" And we would, you know, then go shopping for something we thought was appropriate. Because the only influence on my life at that time was my mother, I very often walked out looking sort of like my mini mother. you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I didn't have anyone saying to me, just put on a pair of jeans and a white shirt, which probably would have felt comfortable to me at the time, but I probably would have had a problem with it because I did believe you get up on stage and you dress up because there are lots of people there and it's important, and you want to show yourself off to your best advantage. I'm a little bit more savvy now in terms of image, but at 16, you don't necessarily have a clear-cut image of yourself.
Well, if you're going shopping with your mother for performances, you're not going to end up looking like the Ronettes.
Exactly.
Singer Leslie Gore is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Leslie Gore is my guest. So what did you do when you stopped having hits?
Well, I did continue through college, and I graduated, and I'd say the hits kind of stopped in 67. I graduated college in 68. So what I did was, I'm feeling kind of like a musician without a place to play, I began doing other things, like summer stock, and getting into other areas of my craft, not just singing, and not just singing on a stage, but singing as a character, and getting a bit more into acting. And I think that formative period in my life has probably stood me in the greatest stead, because today I get up on a stage and I do sing, but for me, singing is actually secondary. The singing is what I do and how I communicate it. But I'm not thinking about singing. I'm thinking about the situation in the song. And what happens is an intense identification with lyric, which comes out as acting.
Mm-hmm. Let me play something that's from the 60s, from an album called My Town, My Guy and Me. And this is a standard. This is a Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song called The Things We Did Last Summer. Was it your idea to do a standard on this? I want to show a different side of your singing.
Probably. You know, the very first album that Quincy and I did together, we had to base it on It's My Party, but we had to throw it together quite quickly, and it was called I'll Cry If I Want To, and it was all cry songs. It was Cry Me a River. It was the Johnny Ray's cry. So we had established a premise early on, whereby I would do standards, maybe with just a slight rock and roll edge. But by and large, I don't think of The Things We Did Last Summer as a rock piece. We did it, I think, just because I loved the song. I believe Don Costa did the arrangement, and a superlative one.
Okay, let's hear it. I think we'll hear a different side of your singing.
Sure.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song. The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long.
Since the early 70s, have you been singing a lot on the oldie circuit? I guess there really wasn't an oldie circuit in the early 70s.
There wasn't, actually. The oldies really began coming back strong, I'd say, right after 1980. About 1980, 81, it really started to pick up. And I did, in fact, take advantage of it. And it certainly, actually during the 70s, no one wanted to hear Leslie Gore. I was writing my own material and working small clubs, tiny clubs, and doing mostly original material. So this whole nostalgia kick at least helped me out financially at a time that it was fairly grim for me. But I did, in fact, put the show together that I'm doing now at the Rainbow and Stars, because you just can't do the same thing all the time. If you're an artist, you have to grow, and you have to find new roads to grow. And for me, this was an opportunity to sing songs, in some cases, I've never sung. In some cases, songs that I was majorly influenced by as a kid. And just an opportunity to get up and show people that there is another side to me. As a matter of fact, maybe more important, to show myself that there's another side of me.
Leslie Gore, do you know what's become of Susan Michaels, who was the president of the Leslie Gore fan club?
Yes, I do. Susan Michaels was an amalgam of my middle name, which is Sue, and my brother's first name, which is Michael. And it was actually my grandma, my Nana, who is no longer with us, who became Susan Michaels and would try to answer all the fan mail personally and handwritten. And that's who Susan Michaels was.
Oh, that's great. So when did the fan club officially break up?
Well, There is yet an official Leslie Gore fan club. About 15 years ago, a gentleman by the name of Jack Natoli, who lives in Paterson, New Jersey, asked if he could be the president, and we turned everything over to him, and he does an incredible job.
Well, Leslie Gore, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Leslie Gore is singing at Rainbow and Stars in Manhattan through October 26th. This is Fresh Air.